Hello, I'm Juliet Foster, and you're listening to the Magnus Communications podcast, which today is looking at cross-border payments with expert and pay-savvy founder David Harrison. Now, cross-border payments is one of those subjects that will always be talked about, mainly because of the innovation taking place in the sector and the amount of money passing through it. Get this, in 2015, it was $150 trillion. Yet by 2027, that figure is expected to reach more than $250 trillion. In other words, an increase of more than $100 trillion in 10 years. So, what's behind it? How many more ways are there to make it easier to pay money at speed and seamlessly? Could technology overload the system? And is there a danger of some people getting left behind in this brave new world of money transactions? So much to consider, but David, first up, welcome to the podcast. And before we start, can you tell me a little bit about PaySavvy? Are you a disruptor or perhaps a saviour?
Thank you, Juliet. I would say, just to answer your second question first, ideally both. You really do want to be able to, when you're working in payments, bringing some kind of benefit. But really, you do need to be a disruptor. We're very used to cash. We're very used to check. Incredibly inefficient, prone to all kinds of mistakes, lack of control. So I guess the two are connected. By being a disruptor, you are bringing improvements. So you could sort of say you're a savior. And from a PaySavvy point of view, I've been involved in the payments industry for over 20 years. I've worked at the banks, I've worked at payment schemes, and I've worked now for my own company for the last 4 years. And what we tend to do is go in and try to provide optimized services so that the technology, which sometimes is astonishing and very impressive, actually translates into a user experience that is easy and not something that intimidates people. So that's been our path for the last few years, and the continued innovations mean we're keeping busy.
Let's take a look at that prediction that I referenced earlier in the introduction, that more than $250 trillion of payments will be transacted by 2027. It's an eye-watering number, but do you think it's right? And what, in your opinion, is driving the demand? Is it being created by technology, or is technology simply responding to what's happening in the market?
Yes, so there's always going to be growth, clearly, driven by inflation, but there's also growth driven by companies improving their supply chains, which of course at the moment is a big topic of conversation, where you make more things available to consumers and businesses and they like them and they procure them. So the trajectory for payments will continue in that direction. But I think you make an interesting point. The technology definitely is a driver, because you make something, anything, accessible, simple, convenient for people, and they will typically use it. And now we're seeing, particularly in digital payments and online payments, something that was clunky and slow and frustrating is now two clicks and very, very quick. So people buying in that way, the technology has enabled them to have basically buy things which perhaps they didn't buy before. There is a separate conversation about, is that a good thing or a bad thing, making it easy for people to buy? But it's probably better, because people who legitimately want to buy something don't have to revert to cash and check. They can do things online or in person electronically.
So given all of that, how does the rivalry between banks and fintechs play into that dynamic?
It does, and it's healthy. I think initially it was seen as a very adversarial relationship, fintechs coming to eat the big legacy players' lunch. In fact, what has happened is they've been incubators of new technology, and they've challenged a lot of things that have become rather status quo and haven't been changed for sometimes decades. So I think it's a healthy balance. I think there are some examples of fintechs who are gaining considerable scale, but they're still a long way behind the major players. And of course, there's a trust issue. People might not like their incumbent legacy bank or financial player in comparison to the fintechs, but they trust them, they feel they're safe, and they will use them for that reason as well. So I think the fintechs have managed to get over that potential hurdle, that they are now able to say, we also have the same controls and security, we know what you want, and we can do better than the banks.
So will there be more collaboration between banks and fintechs? From the perspective of a bank, is it the logical way to go, given the legacy technology they're saddled with, which isn't necessarily up to the job?
Yes, there is that issue about sometimes you are saddled with that technology and just upgrading it is economically not viable. So that entry point is not even for the big players. It just doesn't make any sense. So the fintechs have an immediate advantage because they're not encumbered by that legacy system. But I think the other thing that's interesting, as I've observed in the market, is there's a lot of acquisition at the moment by the big players of smaller players, including obviously fintechs. And the question sometimes is, they buy them and then they disappear. So are they buying them simply to perhaps, take the R&D, take the innovation, and then incorporate into their own systems? Or are they buying them simply to stop them because they need more time to be able to respond? So there's an interesting dynamic about some of these acquisitions are logical, and others sometimes you think, well, maybe it's just a case of trying to take a competitor or slowing a competitor down. So there are many things at play, but there's no doubting the heavy lifting that's required if you are established with a very large client base and a big IT system that is not going to be cheap to upgrade. And more importantly, you may not have time to upgrade it as well.
You've talked about innovation, so let's look at it geographically. Where is the payment sector innovation happening, and why are these regions so successful?
I think Europe is probably, as a whole, when the regulators invented the idea of the payment services directives and the ideas around secure transactions and other regulations that drove fintechs to say we can respond to that. That was kind of a good thing. So there's a bit of a powerhouse in Europe around PSD2, which translates into open banking. And open banking is obviously gaining a lot of traction. And that's because in the UK, the system involves mandated APIs. In other words, you have to do it. Whereas in Europe, they're optional, but they're still trying to keep up. And also in the UK, the Khalifa review made it very clear back in last year that regulation needs to adapt to the fintechs rather than hold them back. You still need to control it. You still need to make sure the consumer is safe, but you don't want to be a hindrance on that technology. So I think Europe is becoming quite an interesting hotbed of technology. The Nordics traditionally are very, very good at this. There is an electronic payments culture, and people are very used to that sort of culture. But outside of Europe, also seeing it in Asia Pacific, particularly in the Far East, there's some very, very interesting technology coming out of the Far East, which is now porting into Europe and having to adapt to those regulations I mentioned. So I'd say at the moment, the ones to watch are certainly Europe and the Far East. There is also a lot happening in Africa at the moment around mobiles and using mobiles for all forms of transactions, which is very interesting and incredibly innovative and is gaining scale. And Latin America, a relatively younger demographic, very, very attuned to their mobile phones and again using them as instruments for payment. I haven't left the US off the list. It's just that there is more perhaps of a manual payment system there. There's no faster payments. They're evolving into that. There's still a lot of check payments, but it is a huge market. And of course, cards are very big there as well. So not dismissing it, there's a lot happening in the States, but I think Europe and the Far East in particular are the ones to watch.
Is there a two-horse race emerging between the areas that you've just talked about with the rest of the world? In other words, is there a sense that perhaps those parts of the world which are innovating, but perhaps not at the same speed, are getting left behind?
Yes, there is always going to be that difficulty. And I see a lot of very localized fintech innovation where you read the business plan and of course it's going to take over the world. It's going to be the next big thing. But the reality is different countries, different regions have different regulations, different laws. And even in the US, you try to introduce into the US maybe a homogenous payment device like a MasterCard or a Visa card, but actually you're still dealing with 50 federated different legal structures. Different employment laws, all kinds of different things there as well. So the ability of taking something from Europe to the US is never simple. It isn't the other way around either. So those pockets will develop, which will mean that those local populations will benefit. But to your point, there is always that risk that perhaps because regions are very different in the way they operate, and notwithstanding language issues as well, if you're going to issue an app globally, the language issues have to be addressed. There is that possibility that some countries, some regions get left behind. I would also just finally on that point say that if the regulators and the governments are tuned into this in a positive way, they have a way of actually being a force for good by saying, look, you know, we don't like cash and check. It's very, very difficult to control. And therefore, they may be an asset, shall we say, in allowing some countries to keep up.
Are you worried that some groups are at risk of being abandoned in the cross-border payments landscape? And what has to be done to get those demographics on board?
Yeah, so there is a lot of disintermediation, it has to be said. I mean, I use the phrase open banking. The clue there is in the second word. If you do not have a bank account, you're immediately excluded from that particular service provision, ways of making payments. And that has to be recognized. There are also people who just don't like necessarily operating in new ways as quickly as in places where it's already been done. So I think that if you are looking, talking about governments and regulation, you need to be mindful of the fact that if technology takes away, for example, cash in its entirety, that is not such a good thing. There will still be people who want to pay in cash, and if they find that there is no way of paying in cash, then you know that would not be a good thing. So it's interesting when you're looking at things like open banking, you are kind of looking over your shoulder just to make sure that everyone is keeping up and that you're not either unintentionally or intentionally disintermediating some significant demographic in your population.
But David, we know that technology isn't static and that at some point mobile payphone wallets are going to be redundant and the world will cry out for new alternatives. What are these alternatives and how soon do you think they're likely to come on stream if they're not already available?
I think in that space, although crypto is to me too volatile to be a viable procurement instrument, you know, if I'm buying something today, I want to know that it's probably about the same price tomorrow. I don't need to see market volatility affecting what I can buy. But what is happening is the European Central Bank are bringing out the digital euro, the Bank of England are bringing out the digital pound, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's a recognition because that does work for people, for example, who don't have bank accounts. If they can get on the platform, of course, clearly we're talking digital, so there is that onus you need to be online. I think that's a really interesting area because it will allow people to maybe operate in a different way, but in a controlled and safe way, because it's obviously backed by government guarantee. And therefore, that could be, I think, not a seismic step, but a significant step in the way people are thinking, because crypto has just opened up a new way of thinking. Blockchain has given, with the transparency of the ledgers, another way of conducting a financial transaction with total transparency. People feel much happier with that. So I think, you know, bringing all of this together into things like digital euro, digital pound are very interesting and will be influential. If they don't become a thing, they will be influential in the thinking of innovators going forward.
David, in private, you and I have talked about vain technology. But how ready is the world for that and also hand wave technology, given the obvious ethical questions about privacy and the potential that exists to go even deeper into the human body to find material that in some way can be translated onto a payment platform?
I'm sure somebody is, Julius. I think it's always the risk that some people are coming up with these ideas because it is feasible. I know the big tech titans have had technology for many years they haven't deployed because it's an offshoot of another technology they've developed. And they've decided for the right reasons that it's not the right thing to deploy. And it is maybe invasive. People don't feel comfortable with it. So I think there is a little bit of a check and balance there. But in terms of fingerprint technology, rather than taking your card with you or taking your mobile phone with you simply identify yourself for payments either through a pad on your laptop or through when you go on the metro on the tube, you put your finger on the pad. Ever since COVID, any form of tactile interaction is definitely not as popular as it was maybe 2 years ago. So I think fingerprint may well be challenging unless you can come up with some way of reassuring the population who have to touch something that many others are touching. With the vein technology you talk about, I think that is really interesting. There is, again, always that thing about it's me, it's my unique biosignature. But in certain instances, being able to wave your palm at a screen, as opposed to having to use a card or anything else, means it is you, and it is much more validating you. I think it could catch on, but the best way to do it is go out there and pilot it. And if the population say, look, it's just too much too soon, then fine, slow it down. But I think what is important is just to test these things out because a lot of things in technology cycles have been seen as the idea was way ahead of its time. And then 5 years later, they suddenly launch, but they had to start somewhere.
We know that technology isn't fallible and it's prone to failure, either through sabotage, mechanical breakdown, or an act of God. If businesses are geared up to take payments digitally, what fallback position do they have when things go wrong? Do you think that perhaps they've neglected that plan B because they're too focused on catching and riding the next payment wave?
Yes, there always has to be a fallback position. So take, for example, your credit card. You still have a magnetic stripe on it. Although they are being phased out, they've lasted a lot longer in Europe, where we're chip and pin and contactless, than is entirely necessary, because sometimes the technology for chip and pin contactless may not work and you can swipe it or use the old zip-zap machine if the card is embossed. So there's always in technology some subtle, sometimes very transparent, backups. I think you make a really good point, though. If you become too dependent on the technology to function at all without having thought through the backup, then you're going into very dangerous territory because things will happen. For example, a power cut. Simple things will happen. And people need to continue to transact. If it's face-to-face, our good friend cash does have a place. It comes back into play. Check for remote transactions. Okay, I'll pop a check in the post to you. Sorry, I can't pay you today. But there is a backup. So people will always get excited and talk about the new stuff, the technology. But at the back of your mind, I've done this ever since I was a student. I always have the emergency £20 note in my back pocket. And I've been involved in electronic payments for 20 years, simply because if there is a backup position, take it, as opposed to be wholly reliant on the technology.
So given the speed of what's happening, do you think that we could ever reach a point when somebody says, enough, because the ethical risks outweigh the benefits? And who do you think is likely to sound that notice? Could it be businesses, customers, governments, regulators, or perhaps even technologists?
I think basically the consumers and the businesses will vote with their feet. There is a point where somebody may say, enough, I just do not feel comfortable. Payments is your money. You need to be so confident and so sure that you are transacting to the person who is going to receive the money and it's going to be easy. I think it goes back to turning your question slightly around on its head is, what is hindering technology is the fear of change. It is also the lack of an informed decision being made. You know how it is when you're thinking about something and you don't feel like you're completely in the loop, you probably won't do it. So some technology, the advocates are having difficulty getting adopters because they can't talk about what is it, the so what factor and the show me. They just can't do it to the point where the buyer is making an informed decision. So there is this sort of two-way street between introducing technology, if consumers and businesses adopt it, good thing. But at the same time, you need to have a feedback loop about what exactly people are thinking in terms of, do they understand it? And that, I think, as technology gets more and more sophisticated, is where potentially people will either just stop using new technology and say, I've got enough, thank you. You know, I can deal with what I've got. And something really amazing and good is coming down the line, but the technology providers aren't able to express it in language that is understood. So it is, I don't think there is ultimately none of this is mandated unless you are talking about government, you as a government decide to impose cryptocurrencies on your population. That and remove the national currency. That is an extreme approach, but I've seen it happen. Yeah, that's where you do have an issue. And I think that's where we just need to be mindful.
That's a little bit scary when we're talking about using cryptocurrencies and things like that. I have a suspicion that that might take us into a referendum and we don't want to go there.
Yes.
But look, David Harrison, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
David Harrison, of course, is the payments expert and founder of PaySavvy. Great that you could join us on the Magnus Communications podcast.